Osiris.
Kush Supply Co., or Kushco, is our wonderful Osiris sponsor and partner who also happens to be the largest producer of packaging products for the cannabis industry. As medical and recreational cannabis continue to be legalized, One Leader has emerged as the go-to company to produce state-compliant packaging for cannabis, and that's Kushco. What does that mean? States have varying laws about how marijuana can be packaged. They need to be childproof, comply with labeling requirements, and so on. Kush knows all the regulations for every state, but the packaging doesn't have to be ugly. Kushco works with producers to create their own branding on amazingly innovative boxes, tubes, bottles, and other packages, so they look amazing and function extremely well. Kushco also produces vaping hardware and supplies. If you've been in a cannabis dispensary lately, you've definitely seen Kushco products. Kushco has offices in 10 states, plus Canada and China. Please go to KushcoSupplyCo.com/podcast to learn more about what they're up to. And we thank them again for being a wonderful Osiris partner.
Hey, everybody. This is the Helping Friendly Podcast. This is episode 149. Matt, we're like one episode away from a really cool saying. It's episode 150.
Huge, huge anniversary milestone, even though we've probably done three times as many of that in actual episodes, if you count everything. But
good point.
Official episodes, it'll be big number 150 coming at you in a couple weeks.
Yeah, and we got something really cool planned for it. So just stay on the edge of your seats as you are right now. We can tell. Matt, where is Brett?
Well, we were hoping that he was going to join us this evening, but he was part of the recent transaction when Spotify bought Gimlet. They also wanted Brad, so we're going to try and get him back, but right now he's property of Spotify.
Oh, man. He's got that Spotify money.
Yep. Living big.
Living big. Jonathan actually is legitimately sick, I think.
Yes. He gave us lots of input. We'll try to either include or make fun of the things that he said episode. But he seemed like he was definitely laid up. So good healing vibes to Jonathan.
Yeah. And we have a really cool two-part episode. We've gotten a lot of fan input and participation. So we're going to talk about that. Before we get into the episode, we want to do a quick little fish news segment. Matt, do you want to talk first about the big Cypress stuff we're going to launch?
Yes. So kind of a big announcement from us here. We talked about the 150th episode coming up in a few weeks, but looking to later in the year, collectively, the Osiris family, of which we are, of course, members, we're going to be looking back at Big Cypress in celebration of the 20th anniversary of what most folks consider to be the high water mark of Fish's career. And we don't want to do it alone. We've all got a lot of thoughts about Fish, as you know, see and hear as you listen to us week after week, and as well as some of our sister podcasts on the network, like Beyond the Pond and Under the Scales. But we want to get as many people involved in this as possible from the community. So we want to hear your thoughts on Big Cypress. We want to hear about your experience if you were there. So if you were at Big Cypress and you want to share some thoughts with us, what we want you to do is take an audio recording of yourself telling us your story and email it to BigCypress@OsirisPod.com. That's Big Cypress, all one word, no spaces or dashes or anything like that. BigCypress@OsirisPod.com. We might use it in the podcast, so make it good. it may appear on one of our episodes, or maybe a Beyond the Pond or somewhere else where we're going to be sort of as a network celebrating Big Cypress this year. So if you have some good recording gear, make a clean recording and send it to us. If you you don't, worst case scenario, try to use the voice memo app on your phone. Make sure there's no background noise or you're not driving down the road or anything. Yes, exactly. No screaming kids, even though we sometimes have screaming kids in the background here. Listen back to it. Make sure it sounds good. It's not distorted. There's nothing crazy. And make sure when you send it to us, you send us some contact information, because if it's really good, maybe we want to reach out to you and interview you. What do we want to hear about? Well, of course, the music. We want to know what you thought about all of the tunes that were played by Fish during that weekend. We want to hear about your journey there. We want to hear funny stories from things that transpired, what the scene was like when you got down to Big Cypress, and thoughts particularly on the midnight set. Did you stay awake the whole time? Did you see anything really crazy, really late at night? Share all of that with us. Feel free to take your time thinking about this. This is going to be something that rolls out over the course of the rest of 2019. So we may have other specific things we're looking for as the year goes on, but we're excited to get this going, and you can probably expect to hear something back from us and start to see some things hopefully this summer around the time of summer tour.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. It's really cool. This is going to be, as you said, a big project, and we're going to get a lot of input from a lot of fans and others in the Fish world. So it's really exciting. Thanks for doing all the work to set it up, Matt. You're in charge, so Make it work.
Ruh-roh. Yeah, no, we're excited. We've actually been talking about this for over a year in planning. So it's really cool to start to see all this come together. And there's a lot of hands on deck trying to make this happen. So I think you should be excited about what's coming from Osiris later this year.
Yeah. One thing I just want to mention, it was brought to our attention that a couple of fans are launching an art studio in Burlington, Vermont. And I'm just going to put a link to this in the show notes. The two guys who are participating in this gallery opening, one of them is a fan and made this amazing print called Rochester 84. It's a print of Jerry Garcia. There were 75 of them made, and just click on the link and check it out. It's really cool. They are selling these, and they are donating some of the prints to Conscious Alliance and Headcount. So there's some good causes there, but it's also just like a really killer print done by a fan, part of the community. So wanted to throw a shout out to those guys. The gallery is called Safe and Sound Gallery in Burlington, Vermont. So if you're up in that area, check it out. But otherwise, just check out this cool print of Jerry. I've been looking at it a lot. It's pretty sweet. The last thing I want to mention before we jump in is that we're doing, if you can't get enough Fish show recommendations, if through us and other venues, we're doing a weekly post on fish.net called Weekly Catch with Osiris. That's the brainchild of Brian Brinkman from Beyond the Pond. Each week we're going to post a link to hopefully like a lesser known show. Brian put the first one up this week. I'm going to do one next week. And every week we're going to put something up there and give you something to listen to and a little bit of a review. So check that out on Fishnet. And we appreciate those guys for giving us lots of opportunities to share more Fish content. So if you guys haven't, shown your appreciation for those guys, please do. And last thing, by the time this posts, you all probably will already have listened to the first part of Under the Scales season 3 premiere with Mike Gordon. I have not heard it yet. Matt has not heard it, but it is coming out in a couple of days from the recording. It's going to be a two-parter, and based on what I've heard from Tom, it's going to be pretty sweet.
Looking forward to that. Always like hearing Mike interviewed.
Yeah, it's sort of unique, I mean, it's going to be interesting. I'm sure everyone has by the time they heard this, heard that, but if you haven't, check it out. So Matt, should we get into a little overview of what we're talking about today?
Yeah, I don't know if we even mentioned it yet. No? People probably could have seen from the title of the episode, but going back to a tour that it probably doesn't get talked about a whole lot, and we're sort of in an odd anniversary of here, 16 years. But the winter 2003 tour, which was the first proper tour of 2.0, we don't really talk about this whole lot, and it's a good time to kind of dive back into some of those shows.
As we talked about, we've done 148 episodes before this one, in addition to tons of quick hits. And I was looking back through to see if we had ever focused on one episode from February of 2003, and we haven't. We've done an HF Pod Plus on one of them, which we'll talk about. But that's sort of surprising and maybe underscores your point, Matt, that we actually haven't really focused on this at all, even though it was the first tour back, right? They left the stage in October of 2000, came back December of 2002, and then this was the first tour after. So maybe deserves more attention than we give it as fans.
Yeah, and I don't know about you, but I really had not listened back to a lot of these shows in a number of years. Of course, when the tour happened, I listened to them like crazy. But I feel like by that summer, a lot of the shows were almost forgotten. And I go back to, one of the shows on this tour that we'll talk about was actually my first show. So it's exciting to talk about that. And then, of course, there's legendary shows like Nassau that, everybody knows about and sort of gets dissected to death. But there's a lot of shows in here that I was kind of, re-triggering memories as I listened to this stuff, things that, 16 years ago I was listening to heavily. And I was actually kind of surprised at some of the shows. I don't know why, but I feel like this tour is overlooked or gets a bad rap or something. I don't know if you had the same experiences that I did.
Yeah, I think this was, for me at least, this was like sort of a weird time in my Phish music collection, because I was just starting actual work after college, which is weird and not cool. But so I couldn't just like sit around and trade tapes or CDs all day. But so I didn't get a ton of the music right away. So I think that's part of it for me. But also just that, yeah, there were 12 shows. It was just, it's sort of an odd tour. And I saw two of them. But it's weird to go back because there's some real gems in here and a really unique sort of take on a tour. I assume that by the time they got rolling toward the end, they were probably not psyched to end the tour.
I guess not. That was another thing I realized, like it's a super, super short tour, even compared to like, some of the tours that they do in 3.0, 12 shows, really only like just over 2 weeks, that they were on the road playing, which is crazy when you consider like, I kept trying to put myself back in the mindset of like what was going on during this tour. And like, first off, tickets were unbelievably difficult for every show because it was the first tour back. And there was so much excitement in the community about these shows. People had this pent up energy from a couple of years of not getting to see the band. And it comes through on the tapes when you listen to it. The crowds just really, really sound rowdy. We talked to a lot of, we surveyed everybody last week on social media, including the YemB Convo, YemBlog. Thanks to Scotty B for that. And a lot of people chimed in about a couple of different shows saying like, man, I'd never heard energy like this before or after. Yeah. Like it was just crazy inside the room. It was so loud. And I was definitely, that was kind of coming back to me as well. So I think you're right. Probably for like all of that to have been happening for to just be a short 12 show run. I wonder if, by that Greensboro show, if they were kind of like, man, like let's keep this thing going,
Yeah. Yeah. And we know that Trey kept it going. He had a spring tour that year, and I saw a screenshot of someone listening to one of those shows from the spring of 2003, Trey Band show. I forget what show it was. And it was like a 30-minute Night Speaks opener, second set. Like they were, he was getting into the jams.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw Trey at the Electric Factory on that tour, which actually that tour was really interesting too, because coming off of the huge Phish tour and all of the Trey Band tours before that, it had actually been in pretty big venues. And then he did essentially like a club tour. It was a real short club tour that spring with the summer tour planned and coming up soon. So those were other like Trey Band shows that, there was like, they were like super tough tickets and people were like all amped up about Phish and everything like that. It was a very, very exciting time to be a Phish fan. There was a lot of excitement and energy going on in the scene.
Yeah, and so we're gonna do two parts. We're gonna go through chronologically, starting with the 2014 show, which will come out. You'll be listening to this, I guess, on the day before the anniversary of that show, if you get it on the day this comes out. But we're going to go through the first half, and then the second part will be the second half. And I will say that all the memories you all sent via Twitter and Facebook were really cool. There was a ton of just, I guess, what you'd expect, travel experiences, you know, people, crazy people you met, show stories, and also just takeaways. But I agree, there's so much. It seemed like everyone had a unique perspective that the show that they saw was like hugely celebratory, or that the energy was crazy. I think we heard that about, you know, half the shows.
Yeah. And a lot of people seeing their first show, like me, on this tour. So I think that added to a lot of the excitement. True. As well. You know, if you were somebody like me, you know, as I've mentioned a couple times on the show before, I mean, I was basically waiting for, God, you know, 3.5, close to 4 years at this point to see the band after I got into them. So, you know, the opposite experience that a lot of people have, where they, you know, sort of went to a show relatively uninformed and stumbled into this amazing experience. I knew what I was getting myself into, and I dreamed about it for, you know, for four
yeah.
years.
Yeah.
Which actually, speaking of which, this first show on the tour, Valentine's Day, little throwback to an episode of ours from a few years ago. This was the first show that a friend of the pod, Katie Turr, attended at the nice. At the Forum in LA.
Nice. Good memory. Way to pull that back.
Yeah.
That was so. Yeah. Let's get into that. The 214. I will just say that I did a calculation. According to my calculations, the average Fishnet rating for these 12 shows was 3.97, which I think puts it. You know, if you average that out over 12 shows, that's like a pretty solid average, wouldn't you say, Matt?
It's pretty solid. So let me, before we get into each show, I guess, did you have any sort of overall impression about the tour after listening back to it?
I guess one thing was that I heard a lot of grooves and licks, particularly from Trey, that I'm more familiar with from the summer, that I kind of heard the beginnings of. That was one thing. And then there's a lot going on in terms of the variety. Like, there's not a lot of funk like you would expect from, you know, the late 1.0 years. It seems like a totally different sound, even from the 99-2000 stuff. That was sort of my main takeaway going back.
Yeah, I can definitely hear that. It you hear the seeds of the 2.0 sound. I kind of noted that they would expand on that in the summer. I heard a little bit more of a bridge from 2099 in terms of like how they took a lot of the groove oriented playing that they were doing at that point, which Trey did a lot of with Trey Band over, you know, the couple of years, and Paige was playing a lot of groove oriented stuff with Vita Blue. And so I think it made sense that kind of the way that they started, you know, kind of adapting and growing that sound. I think, like, overall, I was surprised at how good the tour is. There's some really, really strong shows on this tour. Some of them that I think I probably thought that back in the day, but like I said earlier, you know, just sort of kind of went away with time. And some shows that were really fun to listen to. There were a few shows that are kind of clunkers. And you start to see the problems, if you didn't like 2.0, like, you start to see some of the problem areas when you listen to these shows. So it was a little uneven at times. But overall, I think the tour was actually way better than I thought in my memory.
Well, so we're going to probably get into Trey's playing. That was one of the other observations, that the composed parts were not always great, but right. his playing, the improv, is pretty incredible for most of the tour.
Yeah, all of them, really. I mean, I thought they're playing in general, all four of them. Fishman, too. Fishman's like just wailing on some of these jams. It's awesome.
Yeah, it's true. So should we get into the first show, that Valentine's Day show?
Yeah, so they start off the tour Valentine's Day 2003 at the LA Forum, and come out in early in the first set, did a cover of the Rolling Stone. Which I think it was maybe that day or that week, their first Rolling Stone cover came out. That's the one with them dressed up really weird in the ice capades get up and stuff like that, which was a little strange. But I guess that's the other thing I was remembering is like, there actually was a lot of like media attention on Phish and with them, with them coming back. Like they played SNL, they played Letterman. They were on the cover of Rolling Stone. They were actually getting coverage for like on MTV News and stuff like that. There was like actually a lot of attention on Phish coming back, which seemed a little weird. You know, after they had been sort of this underground thing for so long. And so I think they were poking a little bit of fun at that, but, I don't know. What'd you think about this, the tour opener?
Well, I thought that, I just wanted to use a phrase that my father-in-law introduced me to when he's talking about people wasting time, which is jackassing around, which I felt like they were kind of doing at the beginning there with the My Sweet One and Cover the Rolling Stone and, you know, the Chalk Dust getting back into it. But man, that middle part of the first set with the Fee and the Taste and the Bathtub Gin is great. And there's so many good bathtub gins this tour. That's one thing that just, man, halfway through the first set of the first show, something like that comes, that's a pretty great, it's a pretty great statement.
. 2003 was a really good year for bathtub gin. There was some great ones. That was maybe the sort of the best song of the tour. It was pretty consistently awesome every time that popped up in the set list.
So what do you think, what was Trey doing between the October 2000 last show and then coming back this tour? He was playing with the solo band. He was playing a lot, obviously. It seems like he was pretty well practiced and ready to go.
Yeah, his guitar chops were definitely still probably at their peak at this point. Really fast playing. There were, we'll talk about, you know, throughout the tour, we'll talk about the flubs, which kind of became a theme of 2.0. But I wouldn't say that it was for lack of skill or, you know, practice on the instrument. It was really more cobwebs of having not played the songs for a couple of years and then maybe the band not rehearsing them as much as they should have when they came back. But yeah, I mean, the playing, when you compare the tempos in this period to, you know, maybe the way that they would play some of the songs today, it almost sounds like they're twice as fast in some cases.
Yeah, totally. Well, this show, it seemed like was sort of fine with like a really awesome, the first set was better than the second set for me. But a couple, I mean, there was a good Walls of the Cave in the second set, but did you enjoy the first set more? Do you think that was like more of a highlight in terms of what to go back to?
Yeah, I thought the first set was good. Overall, I mean, it's kind of a typical tour opener. Mm-hmm. You know, when you look at that show without any context for anything else, there's some decent playing, there's a fun cover, stuff like that. But when you look at it compared to the rest of the tour, there's not much there that really stands out. You know, even the gin is good, but when you compare it to some of the other bathtub gins from that tour, it can't even, you know, hold a candle to them.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Well, so they go from one night in LA to up to Vegas for the 15th. And this was, I guess they'd played the Thomas and Mack Center before, but, this is maybe the second run at the Thomas and Mack, cause they played there in 2000, I think, but,
third. So,
97
Halloween. No, so I guess it's the fourth, right? So 97 Halloween, 98, 2000, and then 2003.
Oh, so they only did like other venues a couple times earlier. They did that like Aladdin show in 96.
That was the first time in Vegas.
Okay. So yeah. That was it. So yeah. So they at this point had a pretty good track record there.
Yep. And then, after this, they would play at the Thomas and Mack the following year, 2004, and those pretty horrific shows.
I was there, man.
Led to the dissolution of the band, and they've never played in that building again.
There's no question that first night of Vegas 04 was the worst Phish show I've ever seen.
Wow.
Okay, cool. Let's get back to the good one. So. Yeah. So
back to better Vegas shows, because this is where I think looking back at like the tour overall, this Vegas run is definitely a highlight.
Yeah, what did you think of that first night in terms of the way it started versus the tour opener? Do you feel like it was they kind of kicked it off in a better fashion, or same thing with a couple of highlights in the first set?
Oh yeah, I mean light years better. I mean the first set has a Wolfman's Brother that is absolutely amazing. It's kind of like the anti-Wolfman's. Instead of getting like super funky like it usually does, it gets really groovy. Paige does a lot on the roads in that Wolfman's jam, and it's got a kind of a smooth edge to it that that a lot of Wolfman's don't necessarily have. That, and then the Antelope at the end of the first set is fantastic as well.
Yeah, one of our friends on Twitter, Richard Nash, wanted us to mention that Antelope specifically, and that's one of the things, like the Antelopes and the Bowies. There's a couple things that come up now and again in this tour that remind me that's where like Trey's ferocious guitar playing is just outrageous.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
And Jonathan pointed out that the Wolfman's Brother, to your point, was like maybe one of like a prototype of the 2.0 jam. So you started to hear that same format that you'd hear throughout the next couple of years.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That kind of pushing forward, not in the way that we talked about with 94 and 95, where they're sort of throwing a lot of ideas out there and seeing what sticks. This is more like they get to a wall and they just push on it and try and break through and see what happens. And so you get to these places where it sounds like the jam should end. And in a lot of other eras, the jam would end. And instead, they keep going for 5 or 10 minutes on sort of like an outro groove that gives it a lot of life.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And this, man, the second set here, first of all, there's, you know, the 5-song second set is always a great thing to see. And, you know, if you're looking at set lists, that's what you want to see, right? I mean, you'd be maybe sad that you're not there, but that's a great show that you're looking forward to listening to.
Yeah. And in another sort of prototypical 2.0 move, the 4 or 5 song second set becomes a definite thing, a lot in 2.0.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the I should mention in the first set, the Reba is really nice. But the second set, the Ghost, is just, man, really, really liking the Ghosts from this era. The Ghosts and the Djinns are what I was sort of enjoying a lot going back to these shows. Fishman is just really, really driving a lot of this, right?
Yeah, he does. And this, the ghost is another good example. You know, I mean, around 12 minutes in, they sort of start to push through to it. I had one kind of revelation, and we've talked about this a little bit in the past. Like, I think one really good example that we've used, not to jump ahead too much in time, is the Utah Mr. Completely from the following summer, where you can listen to like a 30 minute jam that doesn't really progress that far. It doesn't stray that far from where it started out. And what I was kind of thinking about is, like, a lot of people have kind of made this analogy that, like, they could, the place that they could get to in like a 20 minute jam in 1997, in, you know, 2018, they could get there in like 10 minutes. But I feel like in 2.0, the opposite is true. Like, it would take them 30 minutes to get there. And that's why you have a lot of these long jams that just very, very patiently just keep going on the same groove or the same vamp for a very, very long time and make kind of a slow incremental process. And you start to see that in this ghost as well, where it just kind of pushes and pushes and pushes. And then the same sort of spacey thing that we talked about with the Wolfmans, and they draw it out for a really long time.
Yeah, and there's a lot of variety too, just in those sort of the 30 minutes or whatever that it takes, or however many minutes, right? And a little bit more of that, like, democratic playing, I guess. Like, Page will go into some sort of weird keyboard thing. It seemed like, I know that he was doing that in the 98, 99 years, starting probably in 97, but it seemed more, maybe just because there's like more space in between everything. You know,
yeah,
not as fast, like, in terms of the cycling through the jams, but really cool. Page and Fishman, and then Mike a little bit later in the tour seems to sort of take over. But man, they're all playing so well right now.
Yeah,
at this point. Yeah. And the part of the conversation we had on the internets, Scotty from the Yem blog and Jambase said this was the genesis of Fish is Back. Our previous guest, Chopaganda, said that, you know, looking at the 215, this five song second set, that was like the conversation that everyone was having. They're like, oh shit, Fish is back, which is a cool place to be.
Yeah. And to be honest with you, when you look at that, the two shows put together, though, I would take this the next night over the first night easily.
Yeah. So this next night, the second night in Vegas, I mean, a Bowie Catapult Bowie opener is just, it's so cool. That's
something that they just opened the show with that. I mean, that's like,
I know,
nuts.
It just doesn't happen anymore. And it didn't happen that much. It happened in like, you know, 93 or 94. That would happen a lot, but it doesn't happen a lot in those days or anymore now. Right. Just,
yeah.
So cool.
Well, so here you have like a lot of 2.0 sort of starting to wrap itself up and develop here. Like, crazy that they open with Bowie. It's not even just like, you know, maybe today if they open with Bowie, you'd say like, okay, it's just going to be like a quick 10 minute Bowie. Let's like, you know, run through the motions. But it's, you know, Bowie into Catapult, back into Bowie. And they do this Catapult thing right before the peak and the landing of Bowie. Like, usually if you saw something like that, it would be during the intro, during the hi-hat intro, maybe they would start messing around with Catapult. But they do that during this jam. And to your point earlier, this was probably the era where we last saw really, really great Bowies with great guitar playing, taking their time to get from point A to point B. I mean, I think it's 18 minutes before they even do the Catapult thing in this Bowie.
Wow. Fire, burn the horse, nightmares fly.
on the other hand, you know, I said, like, play the composed section of this as torture for your enemies and then get rid of them and play the jam for your friends, right? Because, like, the composed part is just botched. I mean, there's, like, a huge section of it Trey doesn't even play. Paige is kind of just playing the you know, the lines that they both play in the middle of the composition. And that,
it's all about the energy.
But that was the, you know, kind of once again putting myself back in the mindset of February 2003 and really most of 2.0. The debate was, like, you know, they were just completely botching the composed parts of these more complex songs, but then they would follow it up with a crazy jam. And so there's, I remember there was a lot of division in the scene at that point of, it was, you know, it was like tastes great, less filling, right? Like people were like, you know, they're completely blowing it. And it's like, yeah, but who cares? We were there for the jams and the jams are raging. And yeah, up to and including Coventry, that debate kept going because they sort of kept along the same path.
Yeah, it's true. And that the jams are yeah, that's why we go. And this is a really nice way to start a first set. We haven't gotten into the rest of the first set yet. When we're sitting here before the 2019 summer tour starts, the last David Bowie first set opener was in 2010. So we're not, you know, we just don't see this kind of stuff anymore. But after that, there's some kind of messing around with Coyote, but then this round room sort of jam is really cool.
Oh, it's gorgeous. Kind of along the lines of what we said before, like they get to the end of the song and they just keep playing that ending and it becomes really delicate and beautiful and great playing from Mike. You know, it's his song, his sort of ideas. So it's amazing. But yeah, that actually was like I just had forgotten about this round room, but a really, really great version and makes me wish that they'd play it more.
Yeah, that was really cool. Did you like the second set? I know you said you'd take this one over the night before. The second set opens Down With Disease with the Seven Below, which was a nice, very intentional sort of transition in and out. But how do you feel about the second set?
I like the second set a lot. The Disease is great. I like the return to Disease. This Piper it's pretty well known. I would imagine of this tour, this is one of the jams that people probably know a little bit better. It's really good. And it goes back into that Disease ending again before transitioning into Makasupa. But I love it. I love the furious playing throughout. I love the cohesiveness of the set. It's really, really well executed. Tough to pick between the two sets, but I would probably take set two of this show, even despite the amazing Bowie in the first one.
And the Piper is, as you said, well known. It's a fan favorite for sure. It does seem like they're building toward like a really big peak, and then they sort of, I think Mike and Fish drop out, and it becomes a little bit more of a start stop jam when it could have just kept kind of building and building. But it's still fun, and Fishman is really driving it.
Yeah, I will say, I think this is maybe the prototype for the rest of the Pipers in 2.0, and there's other better ones. You know, off the top of my head, we'll talk about one a couple shows from now on this tour. But even, you know, off the top of my head, the Camden Piper from that summer, I think was of a similar style and probably way better. But this one is really, really good, especially when you get to the end.
And then you have the one from Miami, obviously, in December.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is part, maybe one of the best, like, fastest guitar Trey I've ever heard. But we'll get to that in another episode. So the Piper really is a jam vehicle this year. That's something we should talk about in terms of this tour, but also 2003. Like, we've talked about that on other episodes where we talk about different tours, like what was the jam of the tour. I don't know if I know offhand for this tour, but maybe we'll get to it as we keep talking.
Yeah.
Do you have a thought right now?
You know, I mean, maybe Jin. And you know, Piper, there's some good Pipers. I think Piper was having a moment because it had been the first song back, when they opened up on New Year's Eve.
True.
So there was a lot of, I heard a huge roar from the crowd at the beginning of this, Piper, and I think that was a lot of people kind of calling back to that show. There's not, of course, you know, there's one of the best tweezers ever. And another great one, but it's not a, like a tour that's chock full of a bunch of really great tweezers or anything like that. So, I don't know, off the top of my head, maybe Gin.
Yeah. Yeah. That's fair. So they go to Denver after two nights in Vegas and have a night off, but I'm not sure the night off, really worked.
Yeah. I mean, good planning on their part to put a night off after Vegas, cause they probably needed it, but, they apparently did not sleep enough on the drive to Denver or the altitude got them to them or something, because this is probably, if you're not as familiar with 2.0 and you wonder why people give it a bad rap sometimes, this show is a good place to start. It kind of has everything that is strange about 2.0. Like, there's really weird placement of songs. There's completely botched composed sections, or just, you know, no energy, missed notes, things like that. Very sort of raspy sounding voices that are not necessarily singing the songs with the correct phrasing and stuff. But then at the end of it, there's like a big yem that kind of elevates the whole thing and keeps it from completely going off the cliff. So, you know, you probably walk away from the show saying, hey, that was fun. Look at that awesome yem at the end. But the rest of it, I did not enjoy you listening to this show, I'll be honest with you.
I saw your notes before I started listening, and then I started listening, and the Runaway Gym openers is great and the energy is high. And then it's just sort of an up and down set, the first set. And one interesting thing is that the Walls of the Cave closer, I think, is of the first set, say 17 minutes, and it's probably one of the longer versions of that song, but not that notable.
Yeah.
Just like, yeah, it's a long time to, you know, not break ground. So sorry guys, but this was a little bit of the Lion Sleeps Tonight, you know, coming out of You Enjoy Myself seems to be the highlight of the show.
Kind
of
cool. But like, yeah, I mean, but to get back to one of the other points, like about like song placement, and I think this came up a lot during 2.0. This was, if you think back to some of these shows, and you should definitely go back and listen to not just the highlights that we'll play, but some complete shows, there's a lot of space between the songs throughout most of 2.0. And if you're wondering, if you didn't see the band back then and you're wondering what was happening, literally they would stand around for minutes at a time on stage between songs trying to decide what song to play next. And I don't know, I think it was like maybe towards the end of 2.0 that Trey started using like a master song list on stage to sort of jog his memory. So there was a lot of discussion going on, and it did make the shows feel very like laid back and, like they weren't necessarily in a rush to do anything. But then you'd wind up with weird decisions about where certain songs go. Like, you know, this show, like they open set two with MoMA Dance, and it jams a little bit, but not really. But then you have like in the middle of the second set, Thunderhead and Divided Sky, like out of nowhere, like kind of sapping some of the energy, maybe that would be a better first set choice or something like that. And then like an encore of NICU and Mexican Cousin. Like, it's just a strange way to end the show. And you'd see a lot of this. I don't know if they were intentionally trying to shake things up with the set list placement in 2.0, but a lot of odd decisions.
Yeah, and the really channeling their inner Grateful Dead.
Yeah.
Yeah. there's like 7 minutes in between songs.
Yeah.
Just like hanging out. Thunderhead, it's only been played 6 times, all in 2003. So that's one of the ones that didn't come back for Baker's Dozen or anything. Might be permanently retired at this point.
I hope not. It's a gorgeous song.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. I kind of expected, actually, I was hoping that it came back during Baker's Dozen when they played 7 million songs or whatever it was. But
yeah,
maybe this year.
This, you know, it's probably worth pointing out, like this batch of songs, the Round Room songs that came out, there was obviously like a lot of people were into them because it was, you know, new album. The album had came out sort of unexpectedly before the shows. They had like, I think like announced and sold the tickets for the, not only the return run over New Year's, but this entire winter tour before they even announced that they were going to release an album, and it kind of came out of nowhere. So there was a new batch of songs. But it's weird because I don't know if you've, maybe this is just because this is when I started seeing the band, but all of the songs from that album always still feel like they're new songs to me, even newer than some of the like 3.0, like Joy and Fuego songs and whatnot. They're like a different style and a different mood than a lot of the material in the catalog. And I love them. There's so many great songs that I wish, you know, I wish they'd play Pebbles and Marbles, for example, a lot more than they do. But also it doesn't sound like many other songs in the catalog.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. A lot of the, well, Pebbles and Marbles for sure. And yeah, there's a few others that like the Seven Below seems more familiar, but there's a lot of songs that I do agree that they seem a little bit, yeah, new or foreign or something.
Yeah. Yeah. And great.
Mm-hmm. The composition, it's sort of like halfway between, you know, the big compositions of Trey's and like just regular songs, but really good lyrics too, you know?
Yeah.
Some pretty heavy stuff in a lot of those. 2.0 was just like a heavy time, I think, for everybody.
Yeah, and I know like there was a little bit of kind of Monday morning quarterbacking or armchair quarterbacking about like, oh, all of these songs are about, you know, 9/11 and stuff like that. Because if we go back, all of that stuff was weighing heavy on our minds and we were at war and it was a strange time that now in retrospect seems so innocent. But like, I think there was a lot of that. You know, we've heard from Tom and elsewhere that was not necessarily the case in the songwriting, but I think there was a lot of like interpreting the songs through that lens at that point. And maybe Fish was taking a shift into becoming a more sort of serious band writing about the times and whatnot.
Yeah, that's true. So Tom has talked about this sort of at length, Pebbles and Marbles and Walls of the Cave and some of the others that you're talking about so we don't have to go into it here, but I really like the lyrics, and I know that there's, yeah, it's interesting thinking about it that way, just like from the kind of zany creative years of early on, right? It did get more serious. Everything got more serious, you know?
Yeah.
Fishman stopped wearing a dress for a while. Like things got really serious, you know? but luckily he went back to it.
Dark times.
Yeah. Yeah. But Pebbles and Marbles is such a good song that I wish they would play more. And speaking of that, we got that at the next show. It's amazing to me that they've only played it 19 times ever.
Yeah, that's just, absolutely.
That's crazy.
That was the one of, you know, I've had this feeling about those songs for a while about, you know, I enjoy them so much and I love hearing them whenever I can. Pebbles and Marbles is one that I really forgot how much I love it and how beautiful it is. It's great jams that come out of it, but just the delicacy of the composed section. It's just really awesome.
Yeah. So this next show, this is where I think in the feedback that we got from fans, this is, I think, one of the shows that where it starts to pick up, where people are like, the energy was amazing. You know, they were outrageously playing, just really kind of on fire. And this first set of 2.20.03 is up there. It's really, really pretty great.
Yeah. If the show before this, Denver, was the one that surprised me at how disappointed I was on re-listen. This Chicago show is the one that surprised me the most as far as being really incredible and one that I'm sure I listened to a lot back in the day, but just was blown away at how great it is. I mean, really the entire show is fantastic.
Yeah. So at the end of the second set, we get the Waves, Into Simple, and the God of Jabu. That's probably the highlight, those three songs. And I really love the Jabu closer out of all that. That was like such a great way to end a set.
Yeah. So, I mean, the Waves Into Simple is really good, especially for a first set segment. I love Waves. I mean, not to harp on how great all these songs are, but I still to this day, flip out whenever I can hear Waves. Mm-hmm. But it was cool hearing this because the waves from this period were a lot faster and drove ahead a lot more, whereas today I feel like they fall back a little bit more to kind of, you know, sort of feels like riding on a wave or something like that, and they're a little bit more psychedelic. These versions were a little bit more rocking, fast-paced, and then, of course, you get into Simple, which once again turns into one of these long explorations through sort of a minor haze and when you get to the end, as opposed to a lot of very beautiful jams or soaring jams that you get out of Simple. This kind of settles into this minor key groove and kind of stays there. And this is a great segment that you could probably end the set with. And then you don't, you have after that, this 20-minute Gotta Jabu that is just fantastic and has a great example of this, awesome guitar playing from Trey, that we were talking about before, but yeah. Then also like the super funky rhythms that Fishman starts throwing out in the second half of the jam. Really awesome stuff.
Yeah. The end of the Simple, it sounds like there's like helicopters landing.
Yeah.
It's pretty crazy. And I think a lot of that's Paige just fucking around, but probably Trey too, right? Everyone's like just deep into the effects. But
yeah.
Falling into like that Gotta Jabu is great. And there's a like this, you know, 5 millionth San Jose tease of the tour and Gotta Jabu. This like every song there's a San Jose tease. Which is great, and even I recognize it, and I'm not like someone who recognizes that stuff. But the Jabu is just, man, it's really, really high energy. Interesting to contrast, like the contrast with the waves into simple, which is a little bit more, you know, not slow, but just totally different tempo, totally different take on, you know, the way they're feeling. They switched gears pretty fast there.
Yeah, for sure. And great way to end that, before the second set, which is just start to finish. Amazing.
Yeah. The tweezer, you know, ends up in retrospect, being sort of a warm up for 228. There is actually, I think there's a couple little riffs in there that Trey returns to in the Nassau Tweezer, but they're, this is a really good one. And I don't know. I'm a sucker for Tweezer into something else. And then like a nice ballad. Like I really like the mid second set Fast Enough for You. That's just what a great place to cool off. I think
it is. Although, you know, that's once again, back to the strange placement of songs.
Yeah,
you've got Tweezer second set opener is, you know, to be expected. Great jam. You know, very psychedelic in the first part, but then it turns into kind of like a prototype of the Nassau version. Super, super rocking, just without the Frampton stuff at the end of it. But then you go into Punch You in the Eye and Fast Enough for You, which is like, yeah. For that part of the second set, love those songs, love them back to back. It's really cool, but it's just odd for that point. But then you get back to the end of the second set with Seven Below and Pebbles and Marbles. So you have like a, you know, 1-2 punch of awesome round room songs.
Yeah. Back Seven Below is real weird.
Yeah, but it's super groovy again, kind of like that Wolfman's that we were talking mm-hmm. about from the first night. You know, Fishman and Page are playing these like sort of jazzy kind of things. I almost thought that it sounded like an MMW, Modesky Martin and Wood song at times, because they're just sort of like jabbing back and forth with the drums and the keys. And then the Pebbles and Marbles, we were talking about what a beautiful song that is and how great some of the jams are. This is an odd version because it's almost like a My Bloody Valentine thing. It just gets like noisy and raucous and crazy.
Yeah, it's really, really great and awesome closer. One of our friends on the internet, WMC Hammer 33 on Twitter, which I didn't realize that was until now, but he said 7 song first set, 5 song second set, all killer, no filler. There you go.
Yep.
What else can you say?
Nothing.
What else can you say, Matt?
Probably in terms of my re-listening, the sleeper show of the tour. Really surprised at how great this was.
Yeah, I actually want to go back to it now that I've already written a bunch of stuff about it, but I do want to go back to it, particularly the end of that first set, just the way of simple Jabu, because the simple I think is a little more complex than maybe I described it. But really, really cool show. And kind of does describe the up and down nature of these shows, right? The Denver and then this one.
yeah, for sure. And then I think the next night then they get into Cincinnati for a two-nighter. This, to me, was almost like a blend of the last two shows. Like, you've got some really cool stuff, but then some real head-scratchers. Were you at, these are Ohio shows, were you at these shows?
No, I was already in DC, so I only saw shows later in the tour.
Okay.
Yeah. But I have friends who went, and I know that, you know, the second night is people love, and not a lot of talk about the first night.
Yeah, and I remembered listening to the second night a lot. A lot of this stuff came back to me. And then the first night was definitely a little bit or not as familiar to me. I probably didn't listen to it quite as much. And when I did re-listen, I probably remembered why. Like I was saying a second ago, you know, like the Disease is really cool. I think it takes one of the fastest turns into type 2 territory of any Down With Disease ever. It's only like 6 or 7 minutes, and they're like, they've completely broken away from a standard Disease jam. Mike leads them out of that. And so, you know, a nice first set. I mean, what did you think about the first set?
Yeah, the antelope, I thought, again, was just like a great example of the intensity and the ferociousness. I think maybe in my head, I thought that by this time, like, antelope was already done, you know, as because I've sort of given up on 3.0 antelopes. And I think in my head, I sort of lumped 2.0 into it. But now that's reminding me that I need to go back to some of these, because just really, really intense antelopes, which I really like. And this, I don't know. I don't really know what happened in this second set, but the hood in the middle of the second set, again, kind of odd placement, is really lovely and seems to be, if you listen to that in isolation, I think you would consider it like a, you might not know that it's from a show like this. It's really just very beautiful version. It's very up and down.
Yeah. Well then, you know, I mean, to wrap up the first set, back to the weird song placement, after Run mm-hmm. Like an Antelope, they do I Didn't Know.
Yeah.
seems very strange, almost like they were like, oh, wait a minute, we wanted to play for another 3 minutes. Let's do, I don't know. I mean, even like compared to other like a cappella songs or something like that they could have done, I Didn't Know seems like such a strange choice. And then you get into the second set and same thing. I had the same experience. I'm like, what the hell happened at set break? Like, it's just like sloppy playing, missed cues, sounds lethargic at times, like singing on phrasing and playing of composed phrases is just like not on. Paige or Trey in 2001 seems to be trying to play all these teases of other songs, mm-hmm. but they don't come through that great. And then, like you said, like mid-set Harry Hood, okay, it's good enough. And then all of these dreams after that, Possum and Cavern, which is a, you know, pretty typical set to closer, and then Awaiting in the Velvet Sea encore. I don't know. It just seems like they ran out of steam or something.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. They did. They ran out of steam like five different times in the show. That's what's weird about it.
Yeah.
It's not like what you'd see in 3.0, which is sometimes I think they just get tired and like the end is just like, cool, we got to go.
Yeah.
But this is like you run out of steam like four different times and then you come back.
Yeah.
All These Dreams is cool. And I when we were looking back at this, I hadn't realized that they had only played that song 12 times ever. I feel like that's just something that they play not super often, but more than that. I like the song, but you don't hear it very much.
I think it was like, I guess those 12 times were probably all or mostly in, you know, like an 18-month period. So it seemed like a lot at that time.
True.
I think that's the thing with all these 2.0 songs is like they played them a lot in 2.0, like, you know, Walls of the Cave. I actually got a little sick of Walls of the Cave closing first sets. In that era, because they did it so much, and now I hear it and I get super excited because it just doesn't happen that often. But you know, yeah, All of These Dreams, Anything But Me, you know, Seven Below was getting played every two or three nights, and they just kind of like, you know, don't really play them that much these days.
True, good point. Yeah, it's sort of interesting. I mean, at least they, like you said, there's some new music to throw in there, which is cool, but not like a lot of songs that didn't have a lot of staying power for whatever reason. Could have had to do with the breakup or other stuff, but
yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
some songs that just sort of like just went by the wayside.
Yeah, bad memories or something.
Yeah, which could have been. I was actually thinking about that the other day as a tangent. I was listening to a Trey Band show and listening to Push On Till the Day, which to me seems like the biggest, most, or not biggest, but the most straightforward party song that like Trey has ever written.
Mm-hmm.
But he still plays it a lot in the Trey Band stuff.
Yeah, it's kind of like Trey Band's Down With Disease. Like, I do like the, especially because of the lyrical content, I'm a little bit surprised, but also like it's got a rip and jam. And that was always sort of like the showstopper for Tab, you know, back in that era. You really looked forward to seeing that, you know, they played it almost every night, it seemed like.
True. Good point. So Matt, we're going to wrap up part one in a minute. One thing I wanted to mention that I didn't get to is Trey's tone this tour. Maybe we can talk more about it in part two, but it's unique and it's recognizable. I think it's one of the ways that you can tell that a show's from this era if you didn't know when it was from. Do you, going back, did you enjoy this, like, Trey's sound at this time? And what's, like, what is that that makes it so recognizable?
It's unique. So this was the period in which Trey was not using the Ross compressor in his rig that a lot of people did not like his tone during this period. And when people discovered that he was not using the Ross compressor, that's what eventually, when they were getting the band back together a couple years later, led to everybody on the internet pooling some money and buying him a Ross compressor because people were not fans of the tone. I think, you know, it's a little abrasive, whereas compared to what you had come from in 1.0, especially because of the Ross compressor, it made his tone very smooth. And so mm-hmm. in this period of time, he's without the compressor, he's playing exclusively through two Fender Deluxe reverb amps, and, you know, leaning on them a lot for the tonality in terms of, like, the overdrive and stuff like that. And they have a very specific sound. And so he was getting a lot of that. Whereas, like, before, even though he'd played Fenders in the late 90s, like, the compressor and the way that it was hitting the amp was probably shaping that a little bit more. So he took it off. Now, the funny thing is that I felt that way at the time too. Like, I thought that his tone was a little off and I missed the smoothness that you'd hear in the late 90s. Compared to the way that he plays in 3.0, I actually don't think it's that different, because I think he plays with a little bit of a harder edge these days with the Comet amps and stuff. I think he's been searching for that. Now he does use the compressor from to a certain degree in the rig now, so it's a little bit different. I don't know what his motivation was for doing that at the time. If he wanted something different, or what was going on. The other thing that I was thinking when I listened to this, there's a big difference in listening to these shows between listening to audience recordings and listening to the live Phish recordings, because the live Phish, if you think back, I mean, this is when live Phish started, right? The New Year's Eve return show, 12/31/02, was the first show that came out on live Phish ever. And this was the start, this period in time was the start of releasing every single show and releasing it. At this point, I think they said they'd get them to you within 48 hours, which seems really funny now. But, like, the recordings that they used were just straight two-track stereo recordings off of the soundboard, which I don't think were necessarily, like, specifically mixed for recording. So the balance is a little weird. There's not a whole lot of audience in them. And so they sound kind of strange when you compare them to a lot of other things. I think that kind of exacerbates the way that Trey's tone sounds. It kind of, like, because you're just sort of getting, like, raw guitar in your face when you listen to the recordings, instead of it sort of, you know, blending with the mix a little bit better. But if you listen to, like, audience recordings from this period, it sounds a lot better. There's a much better blend. So I don't know. Does that, I hope that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. And I think that explains a lot, actually. But you don't think it's that much different from the current tone?
I don't think it's that. I think it's a lot closer to the modern day tone than it was to the late 90s tone. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Cool. Well, that was interesting. And Trey's guitar rig, Ryan, he put up something recently. I think that it set up he looked at in detail, but he has probably even more detail than what Matt just described.
Yeah.
If you guys want to learn more.
Yeah, definitely go and check that out. TreysGuitarRig.com. He put up a whole post where he brought up the It DVD, and, like, he tends to do, has, like, screenshots showing parts of the rig and what the setup was like at that point. Which actually, there used at this point in time, there was a diagram on Trey's website too, where you could actually go and click through and interact with and see what was in the rig too. That was pretty cool.
Nice. So, Matt, I think we're going to let everyone get back to their other programming, and we're going to come back. We have a lot of really cool shows to talk about in part two.
Yeah, and I hear a fire alarm, so I think we probably need to get out of here. It sounds serious.
It does sound serious. Thanks everybody for listening. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts if you haven't yet, or whatever app or platform you use to listen to the podcast. We appreciate your support. We will be back with part two in just a few days. So enjoy. Thanks for listening. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you.
Keep on rocking.
Osiris.